Welcome back to Pedagogy Non Grata, where we bridge the gap between the scientific teaching or principles and teaching in the classroom. Today, I am joined here by Jeremiah. Jeremiah is another education podcaster similar to myself, and I thought he had a sort of a unique story. So I thought I'd try and share that with my audience today and find a little bit more about him. So before I butcher my introduction of you, why don't you introduce yourself, Jeremiah?
Well, my name is Jeremiah Short. My actual title at my school is Core Content Interventionist, but essentially I was placed on the literacy team. So I'm a reading and writing interventionist entering my seventh year in education.
All right. So what made you want to start an education podcast?
Really, I have a background as a writer and doing podcasts for sports. I did one. I went to Mississippi State, so I did podcasts for that. So I kind of just decided, hey, initially I actually started, I would do discussions and I interviewed maybe some people that I worked with previously. But then that summer, I think in 2021, I was like, wow, I'm going to do Phenomenal Conversations, the Phenomenal Student Podcast. I want to start actually interviewing experts in the arena. That's not saying some people aren't on that level, but I really wanted to put a pretty big focus on interviewing experts. I had an opportunity to interview Dr. Louisa Modes, Nancy Motley, Eric Cork, who's an excellent writing consultant. So that kind of started it. Now, I wasn't able to do it as much throughout the school year because I was starting a new role. So you're a teacher as well. So, sometimes it's a little hard to do both. So, but this summer in the middle of the year, I had an opportunity to really interview a lot of people. So really starting a podcast, I really want to kind of put a spotlight one on those experts, but at the same time, right now, literacy, and I know we talked a little bit about the reading wars before we got on air, put a spotlight on that and actually see what they have to say about that.
Yeah, so I thought you had an interesting perspective on this specific topic of the reading wars, because most people tend to come pretty firmly out on one side, but I know you've taken mm-hmm. steps to interview people on both sides. Mm-hmm. And actually, that was something I did myself, too. When I first started this podcast, I interviewed people on both sides, but I clearly took a side at a certain point in the debate. So I'm curious to what your big takeaways have been from interviewing people on all sides.
It's very interesting because I feel like with the reading wars, it is definitely very political in the sense of, in the regular world outside of teaching, you have Democrats and Republicans. And I feel like it's really that way because, if you have friends that are Democrats, sometimes they're very hardcore Democrats, and you have people that are Republicans, they're very hardcore Republicans. And I've kind of seen that with, I think, even some of the people I interviewed, because I've had a chance to talk to people off air. I won't necessarily share a lot of all the conversations we had off air. Some of the stuff's been okay, but you really can see that there are some people that are very hardcore one way or another. And I've heard it be very nasty. So that's kind of interesting about it. And I do lean more, I guess, independent, so it makes it a little easy to receive both sides. But when you listen to both sides, I do trend more toward the science of reading side as far as my philosophy, as far as some of the things I agree with, but not necessarily because that's the only way of doing it. Because even a conversation I had with a person, I guess, who agrees with the balanced literacy model, both sides have good points. So I don't think it should be like one side is dominant, but for understanding, a lot of people do feel like the structured literacy science of reading model is going to be what we're going to be seeing going forward in the next 4 to 5 years. So it's very unique because I'm still in it. And then people don't realize it goes past just in the classroom. As somebody that was a classroom teacher, I had to deal with the balanced literacy thing as far as how those people feel, but it transfers over into how you do interventions. Because if you agree with the balanced literacy model, your interventions are going to be fitting with that philosophy. So I've had to deal with that even as an interventionist, because people think you should do guided reading. They think you should do it this way. Don't focus on funny. Don't focus on this. So in a sense, that's why I kind of have that unique perspective, because I'm actually dealing with it even as a teacher. Some people even start podcasts there outside the classroom. I'm still inside of it. And you still see what's really going on with this actual war and how it's actual teachers that are having to actually teach according to these principles and policies that other people are setting. Mm-hmm. Sorry for the long-winded answer, but.
No, that's good. I agree. Even it gets politicized. And I feel like sometimes it gets politicized along party lines. So I've seen a lot of people who see like the science of reading approach as being a right-wing perspective and the balanced literacy approach as being a left-wing perspective, which I have to say is very frustrating for me as a person who's more focused on the science of the science. Right. Because actually, I personally, I don't think I've ever shared this in the podcast before, but personally, I identify as pretty far left. So to have, and I definitely support the science perspective. So to have people view my opinions as right wing is very frustrating to me, because they're not. I think science doesn't have a political agenda. I think the issue is that people have a political agenda, and sometimes they try to find the pedagogy that fits their political agenda rather than trying to find the answer. Now, I do tend to, as I said before, I tend to think the science of reading perspective is far more apt than the balanced literacy one. But you said that there were elements of the balanced literacy argument that you thought were fair. Could I hear what those are?
Yeah, I mean, I do feel like guided reading, and probably some of the people in my camp are probably like, he's actually agreeing with guided reading. But some of the elements are okay as far as like the guided reading part of it and doing read alouds and doing things like that. But I believe, as I tell people, I don't look at anything as a way of doing things. I look at everything as a tool, whether you're talking about guided reading or shared reading or independent reading. All those things are a tool. And oddly enough, I had a chance to talk to Jennifer Sarah Vall and I asked her about this, like with independent reading. It's something I believe kids should read. I'm a big reader myself. But as we know, kids play video games all day. If you walk, I mean, some of us have nieces and nephews and may even have kids, or you see people out in public, kids are always in those devices. They're not actually, you know, it's interesting. I actually had a chance to work with my younger niece when I went home for a little bit and, you know, was trying to set up something with my younger sister for some things, you know, for her to do. And then my niece knew how to use the actual device better than my little sister, knowing how to do something. She's like, oh, just do this, this, and this. Mine, she's five. But so I said, I told my sister, like, hey, why don't you just set her up, you know, doing her letter sounds, letters and things like that when she comes home. So a lot of these kids are in these devices. They're not actually sitting at home reading books. That's not me saying, hey, don't push reading books. It's just the reality of the situation that a lot of these kids don't do that. I even had a particular intervention student. I taught her sister in the classroom when I was teaching the first part of the year, but I intervened with her and like the sister basically snitched on her and said that she never reads. She's always playing Roblox or Minecraft or something like that. And I would go to her like, hey, you know, your sister told me you're not reading and I need you to not read watch Minecraft or do all this stuff. And she was like, nope, I'm going to play Minecraft and Roblox. It's kind of like, so you almost have to find a way to teach these kids the reading skills without them formally reading. But, and even as Tim Brzezinski told me, you know, he's big on fluency, but these kids need to read. They actually need to read because they will accelerate faster, in my opinion, if they do both. So I think that's an element of what both of them are saying. But I think my issue sometimes with the balanced literacy model, they just say, hey, kids need to read books. But a lot of times these kids can't even read yet. Yeah. But at the same time, I agree with them. I don't think kids need to be sitting up there reading decodable readers every day as their primary reading material. I think that's very faulty. Although I like using decodable text and readers, I think it's very faulty to use it as the primary reading material. Because a lot of times it isn't very, you know, something that they're really going to grow from in the sense of actually comprehension. So I can see what they're saying. So both sides have good points, but I know you mentioned when we talked on the podcast, I know I was listening back. I mean, people were disagreeing and blocked you because of, you know, you had research about certain funding stuff don't work, you know, as far as it has how I come. So I think that's where it's dangerous, even on both sides. I feel balanced literacy normally doesn't provide any data, but I think science of reading, their focus sometimes, they kind of want to hide the data that doesn't really work for them. So I think both sides kind of do the same thing, probably a little bit more on the balanced literacy side when it comes to that.
Yeah, I think it's like, it's a weird thing because we have like a group of people that's really large and encompassing that's calling themselves the science of reading. Mm-hmm. And some of them are actual researchers who are literally doing scientific research and promoting science. Some of them are teachers who are interested in this movement. Some of them are for-profit tutors or who try to adapt ideas that are based on the science. And some of them are people selling programs, right? And there's a commercial element to this too, just like balanced literacy. Mm-hmm. But the thing I think that needs to be always clear is that science reading isn't really one group. It's a group of a large group or a large tent of different people and interests. And they often have different views of what is science. I tend to view the science of reading being the most evidence-based thing we have is synthetic and systematic phonics. But there are people out there who will get mad at me for saying that and say that it's only X type of phonics, whether it's, and I'm, you know what, rather than throw any names under the bus, I think it's just important to realize it's not one camp, right? Mm-hmm. And there are commercial elements to that too.
I was very commercial, and even some of the people have told me off air, like their literal response is all about money. Because I know recently, I think the units of study, which, I mean, I even say on air, is kind of the bane of my existence, because I dealt with that for 2 years, because it's people that really follow Lucy Calkins, and, you know, some even call them the cult of Lucy. So it's kind of with the units of study and that they're calling it back, and because I know she was going to push out something with more of a phonics focus, and she rewrote it, but a lot of people push back, so they end up having to recall it. So, I mean, that's where it shows the commercial element of it. And that's good and bad at the same time. So if there's a program that doesn't work, no, we don't need to put it out there. But where I think the question a lot of people are asking, is it more about kids learning to read, or is it really more about your books being sold? Because it isn't just about the educational resources, the material that kids are being taught. It's about the professional books as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
for sure. I think that's where it kind of comes in, the structural literacy. I mean, I think that's where a lot of it's coming in. So,
yeah. Well, what do you think phonics advocates have right, or science of reading advocates have right?
I mean, it definitely should be a big focus. As an interventionist, you really see. So I can give you a perfect example. And I don't even know if I mentioned it when we were talking, because I guess, of course, I was interviewing you. But I had a chance to work with some kids that were RR readers. And these kids even had worked with another interventionist. These kids were in the classroom struggling. And I came in, and my approach was I wasn't focusing on any type of comprehension stuff. And I know some people, their heads, when you say that, not reading a book, are like, oh my God. I was like, no, I'm just going to start working on letters, letter sounds, and we'll work our way to short vowels, teaching them how to blend, stretch a sound, even watching some of Wiley Blevins stuff. And again, I know people, when you say that, it just makes their head explode that you say you're not reading the book yet. So I focused on that, and they did start to get pretty proficient at those skills. But I know the teacher, one of the students was telling me that she wasn't connecting it to her reading. So I was like, okay, we're going to start reading. Do a guided reading. For first graders, the books are pretty simplistic. It don't even take long. So it's not like the whole intervention is that. So I think where the model kind of gets, and so I would say, yes, I agree with the science of reading, focusing more on the phonics. It only takes about 5 minutes of the intervention. But I think with the balanced literacy model, essentially what they want is maybe 5 minutes on the phonics and then 15 minutes on the reading, when essentially all I did is flop it around and say, put a heavier focus on the phonics and then connect it, you know, connect the phonics to their reading. And that kid, student started to accelerate because she started growing in confidence and she knew how to read the books and her confidence grew. So the science of reading approach and focusing heavier on phonics does work, because I feel like most books are pretty simplistic up until about level I or J anyway. So it's not like you're teaching heavy comprehension skills to begin with. So I think, and again, that student worked with another intervention. It's not throwing that person under a bus, but they were going with more of a heavier reading approach. Because my thing is, you can't ask kids to read if they don't know how to do it yet. I think that's where the problem sometimes comes.
Yeah, you know, I couldn't agree more with what you just said. And it's funny. I think a lot of the debate around balanced literacy versus phonics or structural literacy, science reading, whatever you want to call it, has really focused on three cueing and decodables. And actually, I think that's the least valuable part of the debate, because actually mm-hmm. that's where we have the least amount of research. But what I see it is, it's just this strange, I noticed, I don't know, I was taught as a balanced literacy teacher. I graduated from school as a balanced literacy teacher. I got my specialist in reading and it was all balanced literacy. And I noticed this mm-hmm. strange obsession with comprehension. And I get, people will message me asking me questions like, how do I help my student? They're in kindergarten and they're not comprehending the text. And I'm like, why are you really worried about comprehension in kindergarten? Do they know their alphabet? Like, do they know their letter sounds? Do they have phonemic awareness? And even if they have those things, are they reading fluently enough that they can, that comprehending the text is meaningful to them? And then even with, let's say we've taught all those things and the kid's reading and you still think comprehension is the issue. The text in like a kindergarten class that they're reading, there's nothing really to comprehend. It's like, it's a literal thing. The duck went over the hill. It got lost. Mom found the duck. End of the story. There's no theme. There's no moral. There's no symbolism. What comprehension? And if the kid, I'm kind of stuck wondering if the kid isn't expressing that they're comprehending it. I feel like it's more of, they don't understand what you're asking them, because the stories are so literal at that grade A group. If they understand the words and the meaning behind the words and they can decode those words, I think they should be understanding the text. And I don't understand this weird obsession with being like, let's teach comprehension in grade one, or let's teach comprehension grade in kindergarten. And that's not to say you should never teach comprehension at the time. And that's the thing, you know, I had people's heads explode too when I say this. I had someone get really mad at me on Twitter over this issue. But it's just that it should be de-emphasized. You know, like it should not be a focus in kindergarten or grade one comprehension, in my opinion. Sorry, I've got another diatribe. I set something off.
But here's the interesting part with that, though, because if you focus on those other things and you make sure kids are fluent by the time they get to a J or a K, because people have always told me, well, I learned when I taught second grade, they said the kids move slower. But I started realizing the reason they move slower because they weren't taught all the other skills in those lower grades, so they don't read fluently. Because the kids I had that actually read fluently and could decode words pretty quick, they flew. But the other ones, they stalled. So if you teach those other skills, they will move faster when they get to those things where they actually have to comprehend stuff. So you really say you're teaching comprehension once they get to those higher levels, but you'll start finding that a lot of those kids have gaps in a lot of those foundational things, and that's why they can't move. So it's kind of, I don't know, it's just very weird how people make such a big deal about that. But I was like, those kids, you know, I worked with fifth graders this year that didn't even know their vowel chains proficiently. But, you know, we're like, okay, we could just keep doing test prep stuff. And it's like, these kids don't even know what a long A is. You know, it's kind of, you see that a lot. So it's very weird that people do not want to focus on, you know, and again, I know you spoke about phonemic awareness, doesn't it? And they say it doesn't have a high effect size at the K-2, which it doesn't. But if they need it at the third, fourth, fifth grade level, it should be taught specifically what I do in comfort and intervention. So I think that's where the problem comes in. It's like people just completely forget about it when there are kids that don't have those skills, but they're not getting it because people are just like, oh, just read a book. They'll figure it out.
Yeah.
It don't work that way.
And something I find that often happens at this, when you get to the later grades, when a kid is struggling with reading, people assume that the decoding is not an issue because they give them a benchmark test. And the kid has learned and memorized enough words that maybe they read like two grade levels below, but they still can't decode any words. And there's just this assumption that decoding isn't an issue because they're reading at like a grade three or a grade four level. But if you go back and you give them like a phonics screener, you'll still find that they're lacking those very specific skills. And oftentimes it's easier, I think, to teach phonics at that point too, because they probably know about 50% of the code or 75% of the code. They're just missing that 25%. If you give that to them, it's going to empower them to read that much better.
I can give you a perfect example is that toward the end of the year, I actually, at that point, I'm a regular interventionist, but of course I'm not a resource teacher. So they have to pull kids just by law, obviously. But I'm an interventionist. We're not set by a certain set of rules in that sense of we have to pull kids at this time and all that stuff. So toward the end of the year, you don't pull as many kids. So, but I asked to pull certain students because there was a group I noticed that the reason they didn't move as fast as another group is because I didn't focus as much on word recognition with them. So I asked, could I pull them the last 2 weeks of school? Because I knew their comprehension was excellent, but I knew there was some other foundational gaps that maybe I just missed. So when I pulled them, I actually screened them for like every phonics pattern, even down to letter sounds. Because you'd be like, oh no, there's no way they don't know their letter sounds. But when I started screening them, I had a few kids that, or most of them didn't know some simple a short E or a short O. I was like, wow. There was one student I could tell, I started looking at all the stuff she didn't know, and it had everything to do with the long U vowel. Well, it was a diphthong or something like that. I was like, wow. And it didn't even occur to me at first until I looked at all the stuff that I was gonna actually be working with her. I was like, oh my gosh, she don't know long U. So if you correct that, that's correctable sometimes in a week or two. So I had some kids that actually jumped like two reading levels in the span of 2 weeks just off the fact that I hyper-focused on just certain set phonics skills because their comprehension was already there. So it's like, it's those type of things. So it's not saying that, you know, I say it becomes a battle about that. It's like, it's just simple stuff. And it don't take that much time to do a phonics screener or do those things. You could do that in 30, 40 minutes and get all the data you need. But people, and here's the crazy part. When we use the BAS kit or a Founders Finnell kit at my school, it takes sometimes 30 minutes to test one kid. So you can get data on all the students pretty much probably almost in your classroom in 30 to 45 minutes and the time it takes to do one reading level.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I completely agree with you. In fact, that's exactly how I screen kids, the exact same way. And then when I interview the kids, it's the same thing. I identify the individual letter sounds that they don't know, and then I teach those individual letter sounds. And this is, you know, I've done a lot of research recently on programs, and this is one of the ways I think maybe programs fail is they give you like, this is the lesson for today. And if you have a grade five student, they're behind in reading, they probably don't need like a 1 year long course that spends 1 week on each, you know, or on a couple of letter sounds. They probably need a direct instruction specifically to the sounds they don't know and the skills they don't have. And I feel like it's actually easier without a program. Now, that being said, I have no way of testing that hypothesis, but, or at least not right now.
Well, and it's weird. I know they said a lot of And it's probably gonna be the toughest one. You know, the balanced literacy people, they'll say, and if any of them are listening, because I have some friends, some of them on Twitter and different things like that, you know, they'll say that their version is differentiating instruction, because they said their version of differentiating instruction is differentiating according to reading level and things of that nature. But at the end of the day, it's really ability grouping. So it's not true differentiation. So that's always kind of been the thing that's been weird to me. They said that's doing small group is just doing whole group is like the devil to them. But I know Tim Shanahan is a big proponent of whole. I've never interviewed him. I would love to. I know he doesn't do them anymore, but I would love to. But he says that whole group is the way to go. You know, that's you have to do it that way. And that's how I've taught throughout my career. I taught upper grade and I always did a whole group model and did RTI during RTI time. And I feel like it's always been far more effective than sitting up there doing a bunch of small groups. Cause I feel like, especially so say, for example, I work in a school that's majority Hispanic. If those kids don't have the academic vocabulary or, you know, those higher order thinking, not higher order thinking, but you know, those higher level words, they don't know those words, but you have a classmate that does, but that classmate's in a completely different group because they may read better, but they never get to hear that because they're in a small group with a bunch of kids who don't know the words. It's almost, it makes no sense to me. So I think that's sometimes where it kind of gets distorted and messed up is that, you know, it seems obvious, but people just don't seem to get it. And I think that's always kind of, that frustrates me with the focus on small group models and things like that and the balanced literacy model when it comes to that. Because, and this is why I will explicitly say, I feel like it hurts more minority kids because some of them legitimately do not have the vocabulary to, you know, say the things they need to say because they even call it African-American dialect or because, so say for example, I think the new term is multilingual learner. They focus a lot on kids that come from other countries and was a student's Asian, Hispanic, and their ESLs, but there's a lot of kids that come from certain environments, regardless of race, honestly, they don't have the vocabulary. I'm from Mississippi. That's a lot of kids who don't have the vocabulary to express themselves and understand what's in these books, but that's not explicitly being taught to them. So it's just a lot of things that go into it.
Yeah, you actually, you touched on one of the balanced literacy claims that has most upset me over the years. And it's how it intersects with race in the sense that, and I actually recently, I got into a long debate with someone over this, but they had posted an article about the claim that because some students who come from socioeconomically disadvantaged homes or racially disadvantaged homes in terms of the institutional effects, that they come to school behind in reading. And, you know, we see that in the achievement gap. And they said, therefore, if we teach a science of reading approach or a phonics approach, we're teaching reading early and we'll make these students aware of the fact that they are behind in reading and that will, you know, increase institutionalized racism. And basically their argument was these kids who are coming to school at a lower reading level, we can't teach them how to read because that would be racist. And I'm thinking here, like my mind is blowing with anger. I'm thinking this is the most racist thing I've ever heard. You're saying you can't teach kids reading who have been disadvantaged through institutional ways. Like, I don't know. I think it's just such a twist of logic.
Well, and this is like a lot of these books and things like that, because one of my quibbles sometimes is when I see things, you know, bringing someone to teach them how to make their bookshelf or something more culture responsive. Like, I hate words like culture responsive, SEL, all this stuff. Like, one, SEL is teaching. That's what you're supposed to do anyway. And then culture responsive, I'm like, okay, so say, for example, I'm at a mostly Hispanic school. That's a pretty high chance if you're going to put books on the shelves, they, you might want to put a few more books with Hispanic people on it. If you're at a school with mostly white kids, yeah, they're probably going to read the book with a white kid. If you're at a school with black kids, you need to put books with books of black kids. Now, I think where the issue sometimes comes in, and I kind of started noticing pretty early in my career, a lot of the books with, I'm going to say African-American kids, black kids on it, or, you know, their stories, it's only about some struggle or something about, you know, the civil rights era, the depression. It's always something depressing. Like, they don't want to read those books because I actually once let my students at my third year actually do the bookshelf themselves. I didn't do anything because I don't believe in all the level stuff. I don't do all that. So I let the students set it. And the way they said it was serious and not so serious. That's how they looked at it. And I think that's how kids look at it. So, you know, you want minority kids to read books, but you don't want them reading books, them doing fun stuff, because they like to do fun stuff too. They don't want to hear about the depressing stuff they got to deal with at home. So it's kind of like that's part of it too, is a lot of books. Because even I had an issue with, I found out the lady that did Dork Diaries is an African-American lady, and she wrote it with a white child as the, I guess, the protagonist. I'm like, that's kind of weird. Why would you do that? That's kind of, I don't get that. Like, I know if I did a book, it's hard for me to believe I would make the protagonist a white male student, I just wouldn't do it. I don't see that, especially since it's so popular. So, you know, one of the most fun series. So I think that's part of it as well. Kids want to read fun books with someone that looks like them. And I think that's part of the reason sometimes kids struggle as well too.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And it's such a Hollywood trope too, to like have like a story that has racialized connotations or struggles in it, and then pick a white protagonist for the story. I know the movie The Help got heavily criticized for that, not the issue.
Well, it's kind of like, I mean, it's even, you know, as an African American, you kind of just get tired of watching movies about the same stuff. You know, that's why I know Black Panther just released its trailer, and like everybody loves Black Panther because he's smart, he's regal. And I know, sadly, Chadwick Boseman passed away, but that's why people love that movie. I'm going to say it brings you back to your roots, because I can't even say it does that because I've never been to Africa. It's not my roots in that sense. But you get to see someone being powerful, not being a helper. Because people don't realize, I worked at a behavior school once, and one of the students, and it's a behavior school, special needs behavior school, and we were talking about, the student was having a behavior, so I'm talking about Marvel movies with them, and we were talking about Iron Man, and he brought up Rhodey. I brought up Rhodey. He's like, oh, Tony Stark's helper. And people don't realize how, you know, how, I don't know, that just hit me even at that time. So when you get to see Black Panther, a powerful person, he's stronger than Captain America, and they're the most powerful nation, they have all this technology. They're not, you know, doing, I'm going to say ratchet stuff, we're doing, not struggling, they're not in slavery, it's just they're powerful. I think people don't realize how much those images matter. So I think that's the other part of all of this, I think, that I really hate. I think that minority kids in general are kind of getting thrown to the wayside, when essentially the school system in the next 10 to 20 years is going to be majority minority. So you would think you would shift instruction toward that, but it seems like it's still a bit of a stall, because with all these conversations, they're not really talking about, you know, how this impacts truly minority kids. And I think that's where the problem comes in.
Yeah, I really agree with that statement about how that doesn't seem to be the focus in it. I think it needs to be. And I just also got to throw this out there. Because you've hit me in the feels here today, because that's my favorite Marvel movie, except maybe the Infinity Wars and Endgame one, because those two are just so epic. But like, of the hero backstories,
Marvel fan, like that was because I had a friend of mine that isn't gets into the Marvel thing, and so he felt the movie standalone wasn't that great. But I was like, you have no idea the feeling at the end of that final battle, when you know all when they you know he said on your left. And then Black Panther comes out, and then all the people assemble, come out, and then everybody's been waiting for him to say Avengers Assemble, and they all, it's just, I've watched it probably, I've lost count. Like
that was my exact favorite moment of the whole thing. And like, I got like, when that scene happened, I had like tingles on my neck. I was like so pumped. Okay, you got good taste in movies, sir. But yeah, I don't know. And Black Panther is just such a good hero too, in the sense that, like, you know, you compare him to like the two alternatives that people often say is like, okay, you hear Thor, who's a white god. You have Iron Man, who's clearly supposed to be symbolic of Jesus, and that he dies in the cross and comes back to life to save everybody, only to die again. And then you have like Captain America, who took steroids and slapped on an American flag suit and went in to kill Nazis. I don't know. I just feel like the story behind Black Panther is so compelling, but we're really off topic now.
Yeah. But in a sense, it is still very on topic, because that's a lot of what you kind of deal with sometimes with those things, is like the dynamics of what we're dealing with within education, those two competing. Because even Black Panther kind of had within the African-American community, because there's a lot of people that agree with Killmonger, because sometimes you can have kids debate if somebody was a good person, bad person. A friend of mine was like, man, Killmonger actually was a very bad guy. And everybody was like, oh, he was like, he had a good point. He wasn't wrong, but he was ruthless. He actually was a pretty evil person. But at the same time, you could debate the merits, like with kids, if you're reading books and having them evaluate, you know, he still made some good points. And essentially, Black Panther did agree with him at the end, because they were shutting themselves off. Like, how are you letting your people struggle? You got all this technology. You're more powerful than everybody. They can't do anything to you. You got a whole barrier around the country. And you still letting those people struggle. But at the same time, you know, so I understand. So I think it is a lot dealing with what we're dealing with education to that effect.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, I'm gonna go off topic again one last time, because you've really sucked me into this conversation. But the end scene where the villain dies is such a great scene, where he says, "I'm gonna die as my forefathers did." like just tingles down the spine. Such a good moment. And then he's just such a compelling villain. Like, I feel like that's the problem with most movies that are comic movies. Is the villains are just not compelling. They're not engaging. Like,
because they don't have a point. They just be mad for no reason. As I remember when the movie first came out, I was discussing it with one of the administrators or one of the coaches on the campus I was at. I was like, yeah, most of the villains, like, they're either not formidable or they don't have a point. Like, I'm like, why are you mad? Like, this doesn't seem like a reason to be mad. They killed his father and then shut him away from this great society. So I can see why he kind of was a little upset. Thanos even, he was formidable, but I don't know if he had a good point. He just wanted to kill everybody just because.
He's just a radical environmentalist. Thank God we had capitalists to save the day. and Captain America, of course. Okay, so we're running a little low on time. And rather than engage you on another question, I think I'll just give you a chance to let the audience know where they can find out more about you and your amazing podcast.
Awesome. So I'm pretty much on most of, like, I guess, the podcast platforms. You know, you have Apple Podcasts, Spotify. So I'm on most of those, and I'll probably be uploading a lot more of my content. Go ahead. I have a YouTube, but I haven't uploaded any, a lot of the video interviews, anything, but I'll probably do that as the school year starts. So that's mostly where they'll find me. I know I will be actually releasing a resource for interventions, which are merging of both approaches. I didn't put a sign to reading a balanced literacy label, but that's something I think I kind of do with my intervention approach, is merging both within the intervention. So you can find me on Twitter at Mr. 100 Teacher, and then The Phenomenal Student on Facebook is my actual, I guess, Facebook page. So I'm excited over really the next year, just being able to chance to interview people and maybe them getting to see, because I mean, I interview people, but at the same time, you learn so much from them, because even though I interview them, you know, for guests and stuff like that, you know, I have an opportunity to talk to them off air and get a chance to really pick their brains. I mean, I particularly love talking to the people that I know. I mean, I understand I have a problem with a researcher, but I'm sure you've had a chance to interview multiple people. You can tell the difference between the people that are researchers and the ones that are, you know, have the heart of a teacher and actually are, you know, still actually either not many are teaching, but at least are still involved in it, you know, around teachers. You can tell the difference. So I enjoy talking to those people because you really can learn a lot from them, because it informs me as far as where I should go with my teaching practices. Hmm.
Very interesting. All right. Well, thank you very much for your time today. And maybe we'll have you on again in the future.